The Civil War. Chapter 1. Joining Up. The military life began for both Union and Confederate soldiers in cavalry in the same way, enlistment. Only a handful of the 3.5 million men who fought on both sides were already in the Army in April 1861, when war broke out. Indeed, the standing U.S. Army comprised fewer than 17,000 officers and men at this time, and the recently formed Confederate Army was hardly larger. The bulk of the two armies would be made up of volunteers and draftees. Some of these recruits, particularly in the South, had formerly served in the U.S. Army or state militias, but most had no military training of any kind. They signed their enlistment papers and then learned to be soldiers and cavalrymen. How the armies were organized. The large armies that the Union and Confederacy began building in 1861 were similarly organized. The basic infantry unit was the company. For the cavalry, it was a squadron or troop. Generally, 10 infantry companies or 5 cavalry companies. Cavalry squadrons formed a regiment, and 4 or 5 regiments made up a brigade. In the South, 4 or 5 brigades composed a division. Northern divisions comprised 2 or 3 brigades. In both armies, 3 divisions was the normal strength of a corps. 2 or more corps made up an army group, simply called an army. 1 division, or 1 corps, of each army group was cavalry. In the Confederate forces, artillery units were assigned to each infantry and cavalry division. In the Federal military, part of the artillery was distributed between the corps, with the remainder collected as an artillery reserve. Union Army groups tended to have more corps than did the Confederates. For example, the Union Army of the Potomac had 7 corps, as compared to the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, 3. The difference in the number of corps between these groups did not mean that the Army of the Potomac was twice the size of the Army of Northern Virginia, because Confederate units were larger than Union units. The average Southern infantry company or cavalry squadron had 4 officers and from 90 to 100 enlisted men. The Northern company or squadron had only 3 officers and from 80 to 95 enlisted men. The Federals gave their army groups the names of rivers, and the Confederates gave the names of regions. Thus, Union Army groups included the Army of the Potomac, the Army of the Ohio, and the Army of the Cumberland. The Confederates formed the Army of Northern Virginia, the Army of Mississippi, and the Army of Tennessee, among others. Recruiting. Neither the Union nor the Confederate armies ever did any large-scale recruiting. Instead, each side depended on member states to supply soldiers for its ranks. These state troops were sometimes members of already established local militia, but more often they belonged to brand new units created in response to the war's demands. The Confederate Army was composed completely of such state volunteers. The Federal Army was a combination of regular Army troops and state volunteers. However, the standing U.S. Army only added about 10,000 soldiers during the war, so volunteers vastly outnumbered professionals. For the first 2 years of the war, the process of recruiting was much the same in the North and the South. A prominent businessman, politician, or former Army officer asked for and was given permission by his state's governor or by either the Federal or Confederate War Departments to raise a regiment of infantry, artillery, or cavalry. This individual would enlist assistants to sign up recruits to fill the ranks of the proposed regiment. Often whole companies would be formed by groups of friends, neighbors, or townspeople. After 1862, instead of raising new regiments, southern states sent their recruits to existing northern units in need of replacements. Northern states continued creating new regiments through the entire course of the war. If the established federal unit needed replacements, it had to send its own recruiters out to recruit them. Taking leave. After signing up with a regiment, a recruit had a few days to wrap up his personal affairs and say his goodbyes. If he was part of a new regiment, he would join his unit, which would then travel to the state capital, national capital, Washington, D.C. for the north, Richmond for the south, or the nearest military training camp. Generally, if the recruit was a replacement, he was shipped with other replacements to his company in the field. Taking leave was emotionally mixed. One Arkansas enlistee reported that every young fellow who went to war got a kiss from his best girl, and that last farewell was repeated over and over again. Another recruit wrote that scarcely could be found an eye that was not bathed in tears on this occasion. Traveling. Getting to their destination was an adventure in itself for many recruits. One Texas company left his hometown in St. Augustine in mid-September, destination Richmond. The trip began with a 120-mile hike to the Red River, where the unit boarded a ferry driven by men pushing against the river bottom with poles. From the ferry, they were transferred to a steamboat that took them to New Orleans, from which they took a train to Richmond, arriving some 3 weeks after they started. Most southern and northern regiments did their share of train riding, which was often uncomfortable and exhausting. Civil War historian Bell Irvin Wiley writes, "Accommodations consisted of boxcars equipped with backless benches of rough plank wood and inadequately, if at all, provided with heat, ventilation, food, water, and sanitary facilities. Inferior tracks and roadbeds made for rough riding. On reaching their destination, officers and men were sometimes so exhausted that they threw themselves on the station platform and slept for hours. Union cavalrymen, who were provided with horses after they reached their training camps or field assignments, had to walk or ride the train just like other Union soldiers. However, according to Samuel Carter, while the infantry traveled to Richmond by rail or trudged along dusty back roads, the Confederate cavalry rode from town to town with spurs and sabers jangling. Southern cavalrymen, unlike Northern, were expected to report with their own horses. Mustering in. On reaching their destinations, recruits underwent a quick physical examination, which generally consisted of little more than answering a few questions from a doctor. These exams revealed so little that as many as a quarter of the recruits would turn out to have serious illnesses or physical disabilities that sent them to the hospital and then back home rather than to the battlefield. After the medical exam, the men were assembled and officially mustered into service. The ceremony was basically the same for soldiers and cavalry and for North and South. The recruits took two oaths, the first to their home state and the second to the federal or the Confederate government. The national oath of allegiance was exactly the same, except for the substitutions of the words Confederate States of America or for United States of America in the Southern Pledge. The final portion of this swearing-in ceremony was the reading of the Articles of War, the military laws that would govern these men while under arms. The Articles, which numbered 101, were exactly the same for both armies. The recruits were now officially soldiers of their respective armies. The standard period of enlistment for most of the war was 3 years in both the North and the South. Early on, the Union opted for a mere 90-day enlistment period, and the Confederate recruits committed to a year's service. These short obligations were based on the over-optimistic idea common to both sides that the war would be over relatively quickly. By the end of 1861, it was clear to the Northerners and Southerners that the war was to drag on for years. Password 1. Electing officers. The next step for either a Union or Confederate volunteer company was to elect its officers, the first and second lieutenants, and its captain, the unit's commander. Then the newly elected company lieutenants and captains selected the regiment's majors and its colonel, the regiment's leaders. The generals who commanded brigades and higher levels were normally appointed by the war departments of both the Union and Confederacy. In the North, generals were most often either active or former officers of the regular army. In the South, they were customarily officers with prior military experience. Often a company or regimental election was a mere formality, since the officers were already known. The regimental colonel would be the original organizer who had been given permission to raise the unit, and his assistants, the other officers. However, for some companies, and even a few regiments, the election was wide open, and a period of spirited campaigning would be followed by voting. Successful candidates often provided drinks for their units. As one Union soldier wrote of a newly elected first lieutenant, he made a very good speech and invited us to join in with him in a social glass of brandy and water. The colonel said that it was against the rules to allow any drinking, but this was an especial occasion that would allow it. Our captain and second lieutenant made also some remarks, after which, and repeated cheers, we retired for the night. The losers of these elections sometimes resigned and went home. The draft. In the flush of the patriotism following the shelling of Fort Sumter, volunteers reported by the tens of thousands. Indeed, they overwhelmed the resources of both sides, neither of which had the uniforms, weapons, or equipment to field so many enthusiastic would-be soldiers. Later, however, the situation changed drastically. As the war dragged on and the casualties mounted, men on both sides became reluctant to join up. Thus, both North and South had to resort to other means to fill the ranks of their armies. In the North, a fee known as a bounty was offered those willing to volunteer. Too often, however, paid enlistees would accept the bounty and then desert as soon as possible. Some so-called bounty jumpers made a profession of enlisting, collecting the bounty, and then deserting over and over again. Both sides were eventually forced to pass draft laws, the Confederacy in 1862 and the North in 1863. Numerous loopholes, however, allowed many men to escape the draft. In both North and South, a draftee could pay a tax, $500 in the South, $300 in the North, to be excused from the draft. Another allowable practice was paying a substitute to enter the Army in a draftee's place. Consequently, many wealthy men were able to avoid military service, leading to the charge that it was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. Discriminatory draft practices created much bitterness in the Union and the Confederacy alike. In New York City, on Sunday, July 12, 1863, a week after the Battle of Gettysburg, this resentment flared into the worst riots in U.S. history. The riots, mobs of poor protesting the draft, rampaged for 4 days, looting and burning federal buildings, particularly draft offices. U.S. troops finally put down the riot, which left over 100 dead. Young and old go to war. In general, Civil War soldiers were young men between ages of 18 and 29. However, many middle-aged and even older men carried arms. The Union's 37th Ohio Regiment included almost 150 men over 60. Known as the Graybeards, this unit performed guard duty. Its oldest member and the oldest soldier on either side was 80-year-old Curtis King, who served for a few months before being discharged for disability in 1863. Young boys also managed to enlist despite the stated minimum age in both armies of 18. Most underage soldiers were teenagers, 13 to 17, but the Confederate Charles C. Hay was 11, and the Federalist Edward Black was an astonishing 9 years old. Many of these youngsters were drummer boys, although some, such as the 15-year-old Southerner John Roberts, actually fought in battle. To avoid outright lying, many of these boys would write 18 on a piece of paper, slip it into their shoe, and swear that they were over 18. Who the soldiers were? Union and Confederate soldiers and cavalrymen came from all walks of life. As scholar James I. Robertson writes, from farms and factories, schools and shops, every byway and highway in the land, they came by tens of thousands to answer the call to arms. Filling the ranks of Northern and Southern infantry and artillery companies were farmers, blacksmiths, peddlers, sailors, bartenders, musicians, miners, and even professional gamblers, to name just a few. The urban Northerners tended to be more varied than the rural Southerners. Union rosters listed as many as 300 occupations, compared with an average of 100 for Confederate units. Wiley notes, the occupational diversity which characterized the Union forces gave them a resourcefulness which stood them in good stead in camp, on the march, and during the battle. If a wagon, steamboat, or locomotive broke down, more than likely some soldier could be found close at hand who knew how to make it go again. When a southern town was captured and the occupying northern forces wanted a newspaper, they called out printers from their own ranks, as did the 1st Minnesota at Berryville, Virginia. Southerners take to war. Union cavalry regiments tended to reflect the same variety of occupations as did the infantry and artillery. However, what most federal cavalry units lacked in was riding experience. Stephen Z. Starr observes that if there was a common denominator for the men and boys of the Union cavalry, it was their lack of ability to ride or take care of a horse. In the North, unlike the South, horses were driven, not ridden. The extent of the riding skills, even of most boys raised on northern farms, was to sit bareback on the broad rump of a plow horse as it ambled back to the barn after a day's work in the fields. Confederate cavalry units, on the other hand, were drawn mostly from the southern aristocracy, virtually all of whom had been riding since childhood. Union General William Sherman described Southern horse soldiers as the young bloods of the South, sons of planters and sportsmen. They are splendid riders, first-rate shots, and utterly reckless. Thus, at the beginning of the war, Confederates were far better horsemen than Federals. Steeped in a strong military tradition, Southerners were in general more skilled than Northerners in military matters. For example, Southerners made up a majority of every pre-war class at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and the South supported a number of its own military academies, such as the Virginia Military Institute, where Confederate General Stonewall Jackson was teaching at the beginning of the war. Additionally, there were more Southern state militias than Northern, and these Southern units tended to be better trained and equipped than their Northern counterparts. These advantages, however, would not last as the war continued, and the Union soldiers and cavalrymen learned the lessons of warfare. Password A. They also fought. Both armies also included many immigrants and foreign nationals, understandably in greater numbers than the Union Army, since almost a third of the male population of that region was foreign-born, compared with only 9% of the population of the South. Several thousand Englishmen and Canadians were enlisted by both North and South, and both sides fielded German and Irish regiments. Union units also included the Scandinavian 15th Wisconsin and the French 55th New York, called the LaGuardia Lafayette, the Lafayette Guard. Both sides also had mixed European regiments. Serving in the North was the 39th New York, known as the Garibaldi Guards. led by the Hungarian-born Frederick George de Sessy. This regiment had companies from Germans, Hungarians, Swiss, Italians, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. The unit's officers had to give orders in a variety of languages. The South fielded a similar regiment, commanded by the French Count Camille Armand Jules Marie, Prince of Polignac, later affectionately dubbed the Polecat by the Texans he led. Native Americans also served in the Civil War. The Confederacy formed three brigades of Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Seminoles, while the Unions possessed one brigade of Creek. Their activities were mostly confined to the region of the Mississippi River, close to the Oklahoma Indian territories. Black Americans fight for the Union. At the beginning of the Civil War, many African Americans were anxious to enlist and fight for the Union. Although slavery did not exist in the North except in the border states of Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, racial prejudice did. So also, blacks often were employed as laborers. They could not enlist in the Federal Army, many of whose soldiers were hostile to the idea of black troops. After Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on September 22, 1862, abolitionists were finally able to win the right for African Americans to serve in the Union Army. The first black combat units were formed the next year, although their officers remained white and black troops were paid less than white troopers. One of the most famous of these regiments was the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, headed by Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, a member of one of the most active anti-slavery families in New England. Among others serving in the 54th Massachusetts were two sons of Frederick Douglass, the former slave who became one of America's most effective speakers and writers against slavery. Despite the good combat record of two African American regiments in Louisiana in the spring of 1863, Shaw had difficulty winning the right for his men to fight. Finally, on July 18, 1863, the 54th Massachusetts joined the attack on Fort Wagner, near Charleston, South Carolina. Although the 54th, at the head of the attacking Federals, took heavy casualties, it was proved that African American soldiers were as brave and capable as any of their white comrades. Among those killed was Colonel Shaw, whom the Confederates buried in a mass grave with his men. Offended that the Union accepted blacks in combat, they meant the gesture as an insult. Shaw's parents, however, were pleased, saying that their son would have wanted to be buried with the men whom he had led and with whom he had died. The example of the 54th Massachusetts spurred the creation of other African-American regiments. Before the war ended, more than 100 black units of infantry, cavalry, and artillery saw action. But before any northern or southern soldier or cavalryman saw action, he first had to be outfitted and trained. Password 6.